Welcome to The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the February 6th edition of the magazine. On this week's cover is a large snake, forked tongue extended, slithering up from the bottom of the page toward the top. Displayed against a blank ivory background, the snake's hide is green and scaly, with black dollar signs down the center of its back. The headline is, "The Dangerous Dollar." Our 5-liter articles this week are the cover article, "Greenback Danger, the Age of a Treacherous Falling Dollar." The second article, "Nothing to see here, as global press freedom dwindles, corrupt politicians rejoice." The third article, "Opening Pandora's Box, how to think about new risks of nuclear proliferation." Our fourth article, "The Evolution of Invertebrates, Congress Defended American Science, its work is not over." And our fifth article, "Revolution in Asia, the New Bangladesh is Only Half Built." We'll be reading those 5 articles, plus a sample of international articles from the magazine. So let's begin with our cover article, "Greenback Danger, the Age of a Treacherous Falling Dollar. Those holding American assets will have to get used to it." Over the past year, President Donald Trump has bullied America's allies with tariffs, bludgeoned the Federal Reserve, and treated the budget deficit as if it were just a distraction. Yet most asset markets blithely carry on as if nothing were wrong. In the past 12 months, the S&P 500 index of stocks has risen 14% as investors have piled into artificial intelligence. Growth in America is still the envy of the world. The 10-year Treasury yield, which should rise with the risk of inflation or default, is 4.3%, lower than when Mr. Trump took his oath of office. Yet look closely, and the picture is darker and more complex. Since a peak in January 2025, the dollar has lost a tenth of its value against a broad basket of currencies. As a result, in foreign currency terms, the performance of American assets has been poor. When denominated in euros, for example, American stocks have barely risen over the past year. The currency's fall partly reflects the narrowing of interest rate gaps between America and the rest of the world. Yet, American institutions are also a source of worry, as we report this week. Spasms of investor panic have become more common, as in April 2025, after Mr. Trump announced his Liberation Day tariffs. In those moments, investors flee American assets, causing bonds, stocks, and the currency all to fall in value. More common in emerging markets, that's occurred in 7 of the past 52 weeks, about 3 times as often as in the previous decade or so. When Mr. Trump backs off his maddest ideas, normality returns. But the spasms offer glimpses of a topsy-turvy world in which dollar assets are no longer safe. It's an alarming prospect, given that the dollar is the world's reserve currency and that foreigners own more assets in America than Americans own abroad, to the tune of 89% of Uncle Sam's GDP. At the same time, the price of gold has surged to around $5,000, up about 75% in a year, provoking speculation that investors are protecting themselves against the debasement of the dollar and other tail risks. This should give pause to those who think that America's financial strength is unbreakable. The latest example of an apparent return to normal was Mr. Trump's announcement on January 30th that he would nominate Kevin Warsh to lead the Federal Reserve. Mr. Warsh is an experienced central banker whose contacts on Wall Street helped the Fed through the global financial crisis of 2007-09. His monetary policy record is of an overzealous hawk, not a debaser. His nomination caused the dollar to rally and gold prices to fall. Mr. Warsh is more technocratic and less partisan than Kevin Hassett, a sycophant White House advisor and early frontrunner. Yet the small relief rally does not change the big picture. Over the past month alone, during which Mr. Trump menaced Greenland, the greenback is down by 1.5% and gold is up 14%. Mr. Warsh's history is hawkish, but he has undergone a Damascene conversion to interest rate cuts as Mr. Trump has searched for a nominee. Mr. Warsh has two main arguments for looser money. One is that AI will bring about a productivity boom, which will enable fast growth with inflation falling. It's true that, all else being equal, more output will bear down on prices and that recent productivity data are encouraging. However, productivity growth also encourages investment, for example, in data centers, while soaring stock markets and economic optimism support more consumer spending. The AI frenzy, if sustained, is more likely to lead to higher interest rates than lower ones. In the dot-com boom of the 1990s, the Fed also thought that productivity would keep rates low before reversing itself at the end of the decade. Mr. Warsh also argues that the Fed can offset the stimulus of lower rates by shedding long-dated assets, stepping on the accelerator and the brake at once. The Fed may indeed need to shrink its balance sheet, though that would mean rewiring the monetary system. In the early 2010s, Mr. Warsh wrongly warned that buying assets would trigger high inflation. Today, he asserts that offloading them would be disinflationary. In fact, it would have only a small effect. If the Fed's new chair, once confirmed, persuades his colleagues to go along with big rate cuts, they're likely to prove ill-timed. At 2.8%, American inflation is still above its 2% target. This year has brought tax cuts and will soon bring tax refunds, providing a stimulus of about 0.3% of GDP. If, as is likely, the Supreme Court rules many of Mr. Trump's tariffs unlawful, refunds worth 0.5% of GDP could follow. This combined monetary and fiscal stimulus could lead to still higher inflation, casting more doubts on dollar assets. How far can America push its luck? The country is fortunate that investors have few alternatives to holding the greenback. Precious metals are a poor substitute for hard currency, and no bonds rival the volume, liquidity, and legal safety of treasuries. Foreigners are more likely to shun America's pricey equities than its bonds. And jitters in tech stocks this week show how fast the mood can change. Though central banks have diversified their reserves, King Dollar's share of cross-border banking, trade invoicing, global debt, and foreign exchange deals remains dominant. All of that is a protection against a dollar rout. Yet volatile policymaking and a falling exchange rate make holding the dollar riskier than has for decades. Even if Mr. Warsh is right about inflation, lower interest rates will further weaken the currency. It has a long way to slide. Despite its recent decline, the greenback is above its long-term average in real terms, and according to our Big Mac Index, overvalued against most currencies. The want of alternatives to the dollar condemns foreign investors to bear losses and should alert American investors to the risk of an alternative emerging one day. Everyone should mourn how an asset that is an investor's haven is increasingly tainted by the risks the whole world must now bear. That was Greenback Danger, the Age of a Treacherous Falling Dollar. Our next leader article is Nothing to See Here. As global press freedoms dwindle, corrupt politicians rejoice. Less scrutiny, more booty. Journalists can be infuriating. They simplify. They exaggerate. They sometimes get things wrong. They are disproportionately university-educated, middle-class, and a bit left-wing, so their attitudes often jar with the rest of the population. When they act unethically, for example, when the BBC's Panorama program aired clips of President Donald Trump that had been spliced together in a misleading manner, people are rightly outraged. Trust in the news media has declined across the rich world, especially since the advent of social media allowed errors in reporting to be more widely reviled. So some people might not care much when they hear that journalism is in trouble. Yet it is in their interest to care. Press freedom is in retreat worldwide. Since 2014, the global score on an index devised by Reporters Without Borders, RSF, a watchdog, has deteriorated from no worse than it is in America today to as grim as it is in Serbia, where journalists covering anti-corruption protests are routinely beaten by police. This matters for several reasons. It's not just that free speech is the bedrock liberty on which other liberties depend. It's also because critical journalism is an essential check on state power. If the Almighty know that abuses will be neither exposed nor publicized, they are likely to commit more of them. The Economist analyzed data from about 180 countries over the past 80 years, collected by the VDEM, a Swedish research project. We found a feedback loop between nuzzling the media and unleashing corruption. It seems to go something like this. Politicians who want to rob the public have an incentive to gag the press. The tighter they gag it, the easier it grows to steal. And the more guilty secrets politicians accumulate, the greater their incentive to stifle future critical reporting. Our calculations suggest that if press freedoms decay from as good as Canada to as bad as Indonesia, that is a good indicator that graft will rise from as clean as Ireland to as grubby as Latvia. The process is gradual, metastasizing over several years, so voters may not notice until after the next election. It's worse under populist governments, which typically demonize their critics and seek to crush institutions that limit their authority. One of the most alarming trends is that governments which claim to be democratic are increasingly using tools pioneered by more authoritarian regimes. Typically, they do not try to silence truth-tellers entirely. Rather, they seek to create a media ecosystem in which voters hear amplified praise of the ruling party and only faint whispers of dissent. They use taxpayers' cash to promote fawning coverage, deploying yes-men to run the public broadcaster, directing state advertising budgets toward pliant newspapers, and nudging friendly tycoons who rely on public works contracts to take over independent media firms and neuter them. At the same time, they make it harder for critical outlets to thrive or even survive. Those that insist on doing investigative reporting may find that the government not only refuses to advertise with them, but leans on private firms to shun them too. They may face constant tax audits and vexatious lawsuits. Many struggle to stay afloat. In 160 out of 180 countries surveyed by RSF, the news media are financially precarious. Supposedly democratic governments are going after individual journalists, too. Those who irritate the powerful are often doxxed and harassed, especially if they're women. A UN survey found that 75% of female reporters had endured online abuse and 42% had been harassed or threatened in person. Some reporters are snared by national security laws banning almost any disclosure of which the government disapproves, or rules against digital fake news, meaning almost anything it disputes. The most persistent may be prosecuted for crimes that have nothing to do with journalism. In the Philippines in January, for example, Frenchie May Compio, a frequent critic of abuse by the security forces, was sentenced to 12 to 18 years in prison for financing terrorism. Ms. Compio says the security forces burst into her flat, forced her to the floor, and planted guns and contraband on her bed. Technology has changed what it means to be a journalist and opened new avenues for free expression. Anyone with a phone can film a cop punching a protester and post it on social media, which is a useful check on brutal policing. But overall, the digital revolution has not been as liberating as many people once hoped. Dictators can shut off the internet when their subjects are angry, as in Iran and Uganda did last month. Flawed democracies use more subtle methods. Laws to protect digital privacy are used to shield politicians from scrutiny. Meanwhile, government snoops hack journalists' phones to identify their sources, scaring off future whistleblowers. And if the reporters happen to have embarrassing photos on their devices, these may mysteriously find their way into the public domain. A final shift is America's government, which used to stand up for press freedom around the world, and no longer does. The Trump administration has scrapped subsidies to independent foreign media and shut public outlets such as Radio Free Asia, which used to broadcast to news-starved Tibetans and North Koreans. Worse, Mr. Trump has made clear that he won't press foreign governments over free speech unless they are woke Europeans, that is. From Azerbaijan to El Salvador, strongmen have jumped at the chance to lock up or intimidate more pesky reporters without diplomatic blowback. Apologists for crackdowns often argue that news outlets, too, should be accountable, but they understate the degree to which they already are. Readers can stop subscribing. Subjects who are libeled can sue. The head of the BBC resigned over the Panorama scandal. Journalists have plenty of faults, but preventing them from doing their jobs will have dire consequences. Vigorous news gathering ecosystem, once destroyed, is hard to rebuild. And a world with less press freedom will be dirtier and worse governed. Was nothing to see here. As global press freedoms dwindle, corrupt politicians rejoice. So we turn to our third leader article, Opening Pandora's Box, How to Think About New Risks of Nuclear Proliferation. In a might-makes-right world, many countries may conclude that only nukes can keep them safe. The Danish word hygge suggests a cozy state of relaxation that comes from open fires, woolen socks, and hot chocolate. These days, though, some Nordic defense strategists think that only nuclear arms can provide inner peace. America's allies, Poland, Japan, and South Korea, are also considering whether they need weapons of their own. Some have begun speaking about the need for a Nordic nuke to shield Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden. Others, such as Germany, are talking about cooperation with Europe's nuclear powers, Britain and France. As long as dangerous countries possess nuclear weapons, said Olaf Christensen, Sweden's prime minister last month, sound democracies must also have access to nuclear weapons. At the same time as the new START treaty expires, America, China, and Russia are on the brink of an arms race, violating the bargain that nuclear states would disarm, while non-nuclear states issued the bomb. For almost 8 decades, a relatively stable nuclear order was underpinned by America's promise to extend a nuclear shield to its allies. Whether it would make good on this pledge could never be known, prompting Charles de Gaulle, then President of France, to ask of President John F. Kennedy in 1961 whether he would be ready to trade New York for Paris. Yet American assurances and cajoling were enough to dissuade countries such as Sweden and Taiwan from joining the nuclear club. Today, that order is collapsing. Whereas proliferation used to be the business mainly of rogue states like Iran and North Korea, the talk today is coming from democracies. Some are motivated chiefly by the specter of Russian aggression, aggravated by President Vladimir Putin's threats to launch nuclear weapons against the Ukraine. For others in Asia, the worry is China's growing arsenal. All increasingly fear that it is unwise to bet their nation's existence on America's old promises. President Donald Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on whether America would come to the aid of other members of NATO. American officials recently visiting Japan and South Korea have been noticeably reticent about the status of nuclear protection. Even under a new president who sought to restore faith in American nuclear deterrence, some allies may conclude that de Gaulle was right all along. That poses a terrible dilemma. Some Western countries must feel compelled to possess weapons of their own. Yet their quest for individual security would be likely to trigger proliferation, even in countries that were initially leery of getting a bomb. And the more fingers hovering over doomsday triggers, the greater chance of a catastrophic miscalculation or of a war turning radioactive. Countries have to think hard about these trade-offs because a weapons program might take years. The huge sums involved would divert spending from tanks and jets needed to fend off a conventional attack. Countries that dash for a bomb risk provoking adversaries determined to halt them while they're still vulnerable. Those considering joining the nuclear club could stop just short, creating a latent capacity that could be activated in an emergency. In Europe, Britain and France could work with their European allies to put up a nuclear umbrella. All should be thinking about establishing hotlines and other ways of preventing miscalculations and dampening crises. Just to set out these arguments show how dangerous the world is becoming. The temptation is to take comfort in nostalgia, but that only deepens the perils that lie ahead. That was Opening Pandora's Box, How to Think About New Risks of Nuclear Proliferation. Next, we turn to our fourth leader article, Revolution in Asia. The new Bangladesh is only half built. Whoever wins the coming election has a lot to do. 18 months have passed since a revolution in Bangladesh brought down the despotic Sheikh Hasina Wajid and her thuggish Awami League. On February 12th, the country of 176 million people will hold a general election, marking the return of democracy at last. It's a seminal moment, the first competitive vote in Bangladesh since 2008. For months, observers have worried that violence would break out. So far, thankfully, they've been proven wrong. The contest is largely a fight between two long-established parties, both of which were persecuted by the old regime. One is Jamaat-e-Islami, the largest and most moderate of Bangladesh's Islamist outfits. The other is the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, the BNP, led for years by the late Khalida Zia, a former prime minister, and now fronted by her son, Tariq Rahman. The BNP is the favorite to win. Many are rightly disappointed that Bangladesh's upheaval has not empowered better new parties with bold new agendas. Sheikh Hasina's regime was execrable, But the politics that came before her were also grim. The Islamists, who are about to win a lot of seats, are almost certainly less tolerant than they are making out. And the BNP's previous stints in power were marred by extreme corruption and worse. But Bangladesh's progress should be weighed against its wretched state 2 years ago, and against well-founded fears that its caretaker government would fail to keep the peace. Even the long distance Bangladesh has had to travel, its achievements are big and worth celebrating. The election will thrust the revolution into a new and risky place. As more conventional politics resumes, support from foreign friends may wane. Politicians tasting power for the first time in 2 decades may revert to the bad old ways. And Bangladesh will flourish only if it sustains its enthusiasm for reform. Whoever wins will have to do a lot. The most urgent worry is the economy. The interim government, led by Mohamed Yunus, a Nobel laureate, kept it from disaster. But big changes are needed. This year, Bangladesh will graduate from a group of least developed countries that enjoy advantages in trade and concessionary loans. It needs to make its factories more efficient. It must increase government revenue, which is 7% of GDP, compared with 20% across Asia. And it needs to cut red tape and hammer corrupt bureaucrats who hold businesses to ransom. Relations with India matter too. Bangladeshis are right to resent how Sheikh Hasina has been backed by the government of Delhi. They're irked when Indian officials falsely paint Bangladesh as tainted by anti-Hindu rage. But the caretaker administration was too ready to needle India. The next government must reset the ties. The last political task is political renewal at home. In an Election Day referendum, Bangladeshis will be asked about constitutional reforms aimed at cutting the risk of fresh tyranny. They should back them, and the next government should see them into law, though the temptation to wriggle out will be strong. The new leaders also need to rehabilitate the Awami League, banned from politics by interim government. That would be painful. The League has not taken responsibility for the deaths of some 1,400 people as Sheikh Hasina clung to power. But the new Bangladesh has to be built on forgiveness as well as justice. Bangladeshis can be proud of their revolution, which offered encouragement to Gen Z protests in other parts of the world. This election is a welcome milestone, but the hard job of building a new Bangladesh has only just begun. That was Revolution in Asia. The new Bangladesh is only half built. You're listening to The Economist magazine. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you missed any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it from our website, sunsounds.org, or from our SunSounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's move on to our last leader article. The evolution of invertebrates. Congress defended American science. Its work is not over. It can do more to resist Donald Trump's assault. American scientists spent much of 2025 in shock. The Trump administration canceled thousands of grants and withheld billions of dollars from researchers. Labs were forced to close their doors as they ran out of cash. Fewer foreign researchers applied to move to America, and rising numbers of American scientists began to look abroad for jobs. Worse, Donald Trump's spending proposals for 2026 aim to cut the budgets for America's main science funding agencies in half. This assault on science has provoked a rare reaction from an otherwise supine Republicans in Congress. They have rejected $30 billion in proposed cuts and hardened the language in the spending bill to help them enforce how the administration spends the money. Lawmakers deserve credit for rediscovering the power of the purse. and their spines. They ought now to stiffen those further by using congressional oversight to undo more of the damage Mr. Trump and his team are visiting on American science. The president's budget would have eviscerated research. Mr. Trump proposed cutting 40% of the money going to the National Institutes of Health, which pays for much groundbreaking academic work and conducts plenty of its own. In addition, he demanded that it slash the number of its institutes from 27 to 8. Congress was having none of this, choosing instead to preserve the agency's structure and increase its budget by 1%. Legislators also maintained funding for the National Science Foundation, NASA, and the Department of Energy's Office of Science at similar levels to the previous year. They did not only safeguard the size of the budget, they also constrained the president by inserting language into the text of the spending bill that specifies how and when science dollars must be spent. In previous years, these instructions were published alongside the bill in explanatory documents, which, even though they were not legally binding, the White House intended to honor as reflecting the will of Congress. By writing these instructions into the statute itself, Congress has left less room for a notoriously norm-breaking administration to spend the money in ways that lawmakers had not intended or not spend it at all. These actions show that lawmakers recognized how Mr. Trump's assault would blunt America's scientific and technological edge, killing good science jobs and hurting local economies. Having stood up for their constituents in the budget fight, lawmakers should also protect them from exercising their power of oversight to stop the administration's war on scientific advice and expertise. In the past year, federal science agencies have been shedding staff. Mr. Trump's appointees have also terminated, suspended, or otherwise tampered with the work of some 200 expert committees that advise the government on everything from medicine to energy. Grant panels and other bodies have been politicized and stacked with cranks. These changes are already affecting Americans. Last month, the Department of Health abruptly cut the list of recommended routine immunizations for children from 13 to 7. Shutting down programs that collect environmental data will mean that Americans will be less able to prepare for worsening extremes in weather. The Senate should start by summoning Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the anti-vax health secretary, to explain why vaccine guidance was changed without adequate consultation. Both houses should step up their scrutiny of other committees and environmental monitoring. As with sparing science funding, Americans will thank them for it. That was The Evolution of Invertebrates. Congress defended American science. Its work is not over. Now we'll move on to international articles and begin with this article from The Americas, Ports and the Court. The Panama Canal is a hinge point in Donald Trump's new order. The recent Panamanian Supreme Court ruling shows how the Donroe Doctrine really works. After a year of threats and declarations of hemispheric domination, Donald Trump's campaign to take back the Panama Canal, wresting it from alleged Chinese control, has yielded results at last. On January 29th, Panama's Supreme Court ruled that the contract between the Panama Ports Company, a subsidiary of the Hong Kong-based conglomerate C.K. Hutchison, to operate the ports at each end of the canal, breaches the Panama's constitution. The next day, Jose Raul Remolina, the Panamanian president, said that APM Terminals, part of Maersk, a Danish outfit, would run the ports until new contracts can be tendered. It's hard to imagine that any of this would have happened without the pressure applied by the United States. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said the United States was encouraged by the decision. But new risks loom for Panama. In March last year, it seemed that Mr. Trump's canal issues might be resolved with a commercial transaction. A consortium of Western companies would acquire the ports as part of a wider deal with C.K. Hutchison. But China resisted the sale. 3 days after the deadline for the deal to close had expired, the Office of Panama's Comptroller General lodged the case involving C.K. Hutchison with the Supreme Court. Many Panamanians are angered by the unavoidable impression that their government and legal system are dancing to Mr. Trump's tune. China's Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office called the ruling absurd and pathetic, adding that Panama would pay a heavy price. The Supreme Court's decision cannot be appealed, but it can be referred to international arbitration. On February 3rd, C.K. Hutchison said it would do so. That could be costly, both financially and for the reputations of Panama's political elites who have accommodated C.K. Hutchison over several administrations. China has other ways to hit back. It might decide to put limits on Panamanian-flagged ships, cut infrastructure financing to the country, or push ahead with developing alternative transoceanic trade routes. Mr. Molino called for C.K. Hutchison to cooperate openly in the transition period. But the firm has plenty of ways to disrupt trade. It might, for example, refuse or be slow to offer access to its proprietary software that runs the port terminals. The ruling also hurts Panama's investment credentials. In 2023, the Supreme Court ordered the closure of Cobre Panama, a vast foreign-owned copper mine. Panama lost its investment grade rating 4 months later. And there is the issue of future tenders. Maersk, whose subsidiaries bought the railway running between the two ports last April, is set to operate the ports themselves during the transition, and it's in pole position to win. That risks exposing the Panamanian government to charges of favoritism. Perhaps to avoid such allegations, in January, the Panamanian Canal Authority, the ACP, a state body, announced terms for two new ports and a liquefied petroleum gas pipeline. It is said previously that the tenders would be open to firms from any country. But were a Chinese company to submit the most competitive bid, the ACP would come under pressure to find creative ways to reject it or risk angering the United States all over again. The capture of Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro and ominous threats over Greenland's sovereignty grabbed the world's attention, but the squeeze that Mr. Trump has put on Panama is more relevant for the rest of the Americas. Small countries are vulnerable. The United States now wants a hemisphere free of hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets. Panama could become a blueprint. Thomas Sucre Aloa, a Panamanian lawyer following the case, notes that many Panamanian politicians who once defended C.K. Hutchison are now railing against it with the United States breathing down their neck. The law didn't change, he said. The geopolitical climate did. That was Ports and the Court. The Panama Canal is a hinge point in Donald Trump's new order. Next, we move to Asia with this story, Going Crossways. Newborn parties are scrambling Japanese politics. Though small, they have large megaphones. Politics in Japan has long resembled a straightforward thoroughfare. Most traffic moved with the long-ruling Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP. The disaffected flowed to the ideological left. But the political map increasingly looks more like the famous multi-directional Shibuya crossing in central Tokyo, with newer outfits zooming off in wildly different directions. Of the 10 main parties competing in lower house elections on February 8th, only three existed before 2012. A fourth is a recent merger of two longer-standing parties. The Shibuya crossing is itself a good place to see the traffic shifting. Within the span of a single day last week, the leaders of three noteworthy upstarts, the hard-right do-it-yourself party, the Senseito, the populist Democratic Party for the People, the DPP, and the techno-optimist future team, the Mirai, held rallies there, straining to be heard over the weekend din. Rabble-rousers from Rewa Shinsegumi, a new far-left outfit, gathered nearby. The upstarts played up their novelty, reflecting a growing demand for change. The newborns also share angst about Japan's shrinking, aging population. Yet they offer starkly different plans for the future. Tamaki Yuichiro of the DPP speaks of transforming an anxious generation into a hopeful generation with the help of big tax cuts. To hear Ano Takahiro of Mirai tell it, robots will save Japan. He urges faster adoption of AI, robotics, and self-driving vehicles to overcome labor shortages. Kamiya Shonai of the Senseito, by contrast, rails against migrants and hails Tokugawa Yoshinobu, a shogun who united Japan in the early 17th century and started a 260-year era characterized by relative peace and strict isolation. Such parties remain small. The biggest is the Japanese Innovation Party, the Ishin, with 34 seats in the 465-member lower chamber. Yet they have been able to wield disproportionate influence, thanks in part to their adept use of social media. Ishin has become the LDP's new coalition partner. The DPP has negotiated with the ruling coalition to push through a pet tax policy. Senseito has thrust immigration to the center of debate. To claim success in the election, the upstarts need not take power, just maintain their forward motion. That was Going Crossways. Newborn parties are scrambling Japanese politics. From Japan, we move to the Middle East with this story, Still Stuck. The reopened Rafah crossing in Gaza brings pitiful gains. Gaza's beautiful technocrats are still languishing in Cairo. In theory, Gaza is on the road to recovery. Donald Trump's Board of Peace has appointed a panel of Palestinian technocrats, the National Committee for Administration of Gaza, the NCAG, to govern the strip in place of Hamas. At Davos, the World Economic Forum's jamboree, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, unveiled a glossy reconstruction map of the strip, replete with a sparkling corniche. Israel has recovered all of its hostages, dead and alive, clearing the way for the second phase of the president's peace plan, rebuilding. And on February 2nd, it reopened the Rafah crossing with Egypt, which has been largely closed since May of 2024. The reality is grimmer. Since the ceasefire, Israeli airstrikes have killed about 500 Palestinians in Gaza. More food is entering the strip, but many items, such as tomatoes, remain a luxury. Over a million people still shelter in ruins or tents. Few have electricity. Severe respiratory infections are increasing rapidly. Israel has ordered Médecins Sans Frontières and other aid agencies to leave because they have refused to provide lists of their staff without assurances that they would not become targets. It has previously alleged that employees of the UN's Refugee Agency for Palestinians had taken part in the massacres of October 7th. The Rafah crossing was originally meant to open soon after the truce in October. On the day it did, Israel allowed just 5 patients and 7 relatives to leave. Around 20,000 Gazans need urgent medical treatment abroad. Of the 50 people registered to return to Gaza that day, only 3 women and 9 children were let in. They said crossing the border took over 15 hours and that they faced EU monitors, a Palestinian militia tied to Israel and Israeli goons who blindfolded, handcuffed, and interrogated them. As part of the ceasefire, Hamas agreed to hand power to the NCAG. Israel has not yet let the committee even enter Gaza. It has no funding and no bank account. Its members are waiting in a Cairo hotel. An attempt to assert some legitimacy by unveiling a logo based on that of the Palestinian Authority was swiftly withdrawn after Israel objected. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, is insisting all money for the group flow through him. American and Israeli firms eyeing lucrative contracts for looking at the United Arab Emirates to pay for reconstruction. But on February 2nd, the UAE denied any such plans. Steve Witkoff, Mr. Trump's envoy, continues to shuttle to Jerusalem, hoping to persuade Israel not to torpedo his boss's vision for Gaza. So, a vicious cycle spins on. Nothing meaningful can happen in Gaza until Hamas disarms, Israel says. It will not withdraw from the Strip until an international stabilization force has completed disarming the group and the Strip has been demilitarized. That force has not materialized. Meanwhile, Hamas may be reconsidering its promise to disarm. It points to the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, which Israel has starved of customs revenues and brought it to the brink of collapse despite its close security coordination with Israel. On February 3rd, a gunman in Gaza fired on an Israeli patrol, wounding an officer. Israel launched airstrikes, killing 20 people and briefly closed the crossing at Rafah. That was Still Stuck. The reopened Rafah crossing in Gaza brings pitiful gains. In the Middle East, we move to China with this article. Chinese checkups. Why more foreigners are seeking healthcare in China. The growth of medical tourism is making locals uneasy. Foreigners visiting China often gush over the country's high-speed rail and glittering skylines. Its creaky medical system, though, gets less praise. So Amy, a British woman, caused a stir online last month with a glowing video review of a public hospital in Beijing. With persistent stomach trouble and facing a long wait to see a doctor in Britain, she went to China, where she had once lived. Test, diagnosis, and treatment were quick and cost about 2,800 yuan, about $400. Even including the airfare, that was still less than she would have had to pay at a private hospital at home, she said. After Amy's video went viral on Chinese social media, other foreigners chimed in with their own stories of cheap and efficient care in China. A decade ago, officials set a target for China to become an internationally competitive destination for medical tourism by 2030, as South Korea has become. Wealthy Chinese often visit that country for complex treatments or cosmetic surgery. Now China is drawing a growing number of foreign patients. Last year, its hospitals received nearly 1.3 million of them, up almost 74% from 2022, according to the Chinese media. China's medical tourism market is expected to increase from around 1.2 billion in 2025 to 3.4 billion by 2035, according to market research firm Consultancy. Many of China's medical facilities are still shoddy, but in recent years, its best hospitals have gained top-notch doctors and equipment. For some elective procedures, such as laser eye surgery, they're world-class. They're also usually cheaper than Western hospitals. Many have English-speaking staff, and since 2023, China has fast expanded its visa-free entry scheme. Last month, it announced that British visitors would be included. This makes it easier to drop in for a checkup. Most of the foreigners to be found in Chinese hospitals are still residents rather than medical tourists. But big cities like Shanghai and Beijing are starting to receive more patients from abroad. Growing numbers of Vietnamese are seeking treatments in hospitals in southern China. And Russians are popping up over the border to hospitals in the northeast. State media said this is an encouraging sign of the country's growing appeal to patients overseas. Compared with some Western countries, China's medical system provides more efficient and affordable care, a researcher told China Daily, a state newspaper. Such messages chime with the current propaganda campaign to paint America as a precarious place where one bad illness can ruin someone financially. But some Chinese worry about possible new strains on China's medical system, which is largely publicly funded. Chinese doctors are hugely overworked. Queues often snake around hospitals. Foreigners coming here to enjoy the benefits of Chinese taxpayers isn't fair, said one commenter on Amy's video. Will foreigners seize our medical resources? Asked an article on WeChat, a social media app. Such worries appear overblown. Public hospitals are only allowed to use 10% of capacity for international departments. But it's a rare case where China's nationalists dislike one of their country's success stories. That was Chinese Checkups, Why More Foreigners Are Seeking Healthcare in China. And finally, we return back to the United States for this article, Politicians Picking Voters, Voting Rights and Wrongs in America. Squabbles over the Voting Rights Act could boost black turnout. In an ideal world, voting districts would be calmly demarcated by an impartial computer. In America, the job is often done by state legislatures, in effect granting politicians the power to pick their own voters. Parties want to maximize their tally of the seats. Incumbents want to maximize their chances of re-election. And the courts try to enforce the Voting Rights Act, which was passed in 1965 to end racial discrimination in elections. Under Jim Crow, discrimination meant preventing blacks in the South from voting, often via poll taxes and impossible literacy tests, from which whites were largely exempted. Today, Americans disagree as to what counts as discrimination. Some think states should maximize the number of majority black districts wherever practical so that blacks can, as the Supreme Court put it in 1986, elect their preferred representatives. Others think that this approach is itself racially discriminatory, violating the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, and that maps should be drawn without regard to skin color. Almost no one trusts the politicians to do any of this fairly. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act allows plaintiffs to sue states for drawing districts that dilute the power of minority voters. In the past four decades, 466 such cases have gone to courts. Most were in the South and over local races, such as for city council and school boards. But they've also shaped Congress. In 2024, Shomari Figures, a black Democrat, was elected after a lawsuit forced Alabama to create a new majority-minority district stretching from Mobile to Montgomery. Now, a legal challenge in another state, Louisiana versus Calais, threatens to rejig the lines again. Blacks are one-third of Louisiana's voters, but a map drawn up after the 2020 census included only one black district out of six. Black plaintiffs sued, and a court ordered the creation of a second such district. But then a group of non-African-American voters, in quotes, challenged that, calling it racially balkanizing. A different court ruled in their favor, striking down the redrawn map. The case reached the Supreme Court last March, and a second oral argument was heard in October. Conservative justices sound ready to make it much harder for plaintiffs to challenge maps for allegedly diluting the influence of minority voters. If the ruling, expected this spring, goes that way, a quarter or more of the Congressional Black Caucus might be voted out. But the fallout might not be quite so simple. James Carville, a Democratic strategist from New Orleans, says a ruling perceived as anti-black could help Democrats. How do you get a 25-year-old black car mechanic in Atlanta to go to the polls? Tell them Republicans don't respect you and that they're counting on you not to vote, he said. Surveys show that young black voters care more about the economy than civil rights. But if the VRA is seen as under threat, that could change. This would jack up anger in the African-American community, and anger drives turnout, said John Anzalone, a Democratic pollster. Turnout matters in statewide races, which cannot be gerrymandered. State borders are not up for discussion, unless you count Greenland. Raising black turnout could matter a lot in the South. Blacks are numerous there and cast ballots at lower rates than whites do. In North Carolina, Democrats win more statewide ballots if voters in Charlotte, a mostly black and Hispanic city, turned out as much as those in whiter Raleigh and Durham, says Morgan Jackson, a political operative. The same could hold in Georgia, perhaps the South's most purple state. Louisiana's filing deadline for congressional candidates is on February 13th, so the Supreme Court is unlikely to rule in time to let Republicans remove one or both of their state's majority black districts before this year's midterm elections. Michael Lee of the Brennan Center, a think tank, thinks the same is true in other southern states. But district lines for future elections could change. If they do, Nick Stephanopoulos of Harvard says that Republicans would enjoy a structural advantage in the House of Representatives and state legislatures for as long as the current political coalitions last. Those conditions include deep partisan distrust. President Donald Trump, who tried to overturn the results of an election he lost in 2020, spoke this week of nationalizing elections, deploying the federal government to states where he claims, without evidence, that voter fraud is rife. The White House downplayed his unconstitutional suggestion, but Democrats are nervous. Mr. Figures said his district, a cradle of the civil rights struggle, knows what's at stake. That was Politicians Picking Voters, Voting Rights and Wrongs in America. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the February 6th edition of The Economist. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell, and it's been my pleasure to read them to you. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for another edition of The Economist, and stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.